Silent Spring, Disc 2.
In Greek mythology, the sorceress Medea, enraged at being supplanted by a rival for the affections of her husband Jason, presented the new bride with a robe possessing magic properties. The wearer of the robe immediately suffered a violent death. This death by indirection now finds its counterpart in what are known as systemic insecticides. These are chemicals with extraordinary properties which are used to convert plants or animals into a sort of Medea's robe by making them actually poisonous. This is done with the purpose of killing insects that may come in contact with them, especially by sucking their juices or blood. The world of systemic insecticides is a weird world, surpassing the imaginings of the Brothers Grimm, perhaps most closely akin to the cartoon world of Charles Adams. It is a world where the enchanted forest of the fairy tales has become the poisonous forest in which an insect that chews a leaf or sucks the sap of a plant is doomed. It is a world where a flea bites a dog and dies because the dog's blood has been made poisonous, where an insect may die from vapors emanating from a plant it has never touched, where a bee may carry poisonous nectar back to its hive and presently produce poisonous honey. The entomologist's dream of the built-in insecticide was born when workers in the field of applied entomology realized that they could take a hint from nature. They found that wheat growing in soil containing sodium selenate was immune to attack by aphids or spider mites. Selenium, a naturally occurring element found sparingly in rocks and soils of many parts of the world, thus became the first systemic insecticide. What makes an insecticide a systemic is the ability to permeate all the tissues of a plant or animal and make them toxic. This quality is possessed by some chemicals of the chlorinated hydrocarbon group and by others of the organophosphorus group, all synthetically produced, as well as by certain naturally occurring substances. In practice, however, most systemics are drawn from the organophosphorus group because the problem of residues is somewhat less acute. Systemics act in other devious ways. Applied to seeds, either by soaking or in a coating combined with carbon, they extend their effects into the following plant generation and produce seedlings poisonous to aphids or other sucking insects. Vegetables such as peas, beans, and sugar beets are sometimes thus protected. Cotton seeds coated with a systemic insecticide have been in use for some time in California, where 25 farm laborers planting cotton in the San Joaquin Valley in 1959 were seized with sudden illness caused by handling the bags of treated seeds. In England, someone wondered what happened when bees made use of nectar from plants treated with systemics. This was investigated in areas treated with a chemical called Schraden. Although the plants had been sprayed before the flowers were formed, the nectar later produced contained the poison. The result, as might have been predicted, was that the honey made by the bees also was contaminated with Schraden. Use of animal systemics has concentrated chiefly on control of the cattle grub, a damaging parasite of livestock. Extreme care must be used in order to create an insecticidal effect in the blood and tissues of the host without setting up a fatal poisoning. The balance is delicate, and government veterinarians have found that repeated small doses can gradually deplete an animal's supply of the protective enzyme cholinesterase, so that without warning, a minute additional dose will cause poisoning. There are strong indications that fields closer to our daily lives are being opened up. You may now give your dog a pill, which, it is claimed, will rid him of fleas by making his blood poisonous to them. The hazards discovered in treating cattle would presumably apply to the dog. As yet, no one seems to have proposed a human systemic that would make us lethal to a mosquito. Perhaps this is the next step. So far in this chapter, we've been discussing the deadly chemicals that are being used in our war against the insects. What of our simultaneous war against the weeds? The desire for a quick and easy method of killing unwanted plants has given rise to a large and growing array of chemicals that are known as herbicides, or less formally, as weed killers. The story of how these chemicals are used and misused will be told in Chapter 6. The question that here concerns us is whether the weed killers are poisons and whether their use is contributing to the poisoning of the environment. The legend that the herbicides are toxic only to plants and so pose no threat to animal life has been widely disseminated, but unfortunately, it isn't true. The plant killers include a large variety of chemicals that act on animal tissue as well as on vegetation. They vary greatly in their action on the organism. Some are general poisons, some are powerful stimulants of metabolism, causing a fatal rise in body temperature. Some induce malignant tumors, either alone or in partnership with other chemicals. Some strike at the genetic material of the race by causing gene mutations. The herbicides, then, like the insecticides, include some very dangerous chemicals, and their careless use in the belief that they are safe can have disastrous results. Despite the competition of a constant stream of new chemicals issuing from the laboratories, arsenic compounds are still liberally used, both as insecticides, as mentioned above, and as weed killers, where they usually take the chemical form of sodium arsenite. The history of their use is not reassuring. As roadside sprays, they have cost many a farmer his cow and killed uncounted numbers of wild creatures. As aquatic weed killers in lakes and reservoirs, they have made public waters unsuitable for drinking or even for swimming. As a spray applied to potato fields to destroy the vines, they have taken a toll of human and non-human life. In England, this latter practice developed about 1951 as a result of a shortage of sulfuric acid, formerly used to burn off the potato vines. The Ministry of Agriculture considered it necessary to give warning of the hazard of going into arsenic-sprayed fields. But the warning was not understood by the cattle, nor, we must assume, by the wild animals and birds. And reports of cattle poisoned by the arsenic sprays came with monotonous regularity. When death came also to a farmer's wife through arsenic-contaminated water, one of the major English chemical companies in 1959 stopped production of arsenical sprays and called in supplies already in the hands of dealers. And shortly thereafter, the Ministry of Agriculture announced that because of high risks to people and cattle, restrictions on the use of arsenites would be imposed. In 1961, the Australian government announced a similar ban. No such restrictions impede the use of these poisons in the United States, however. Some of the dinitro compounds are also used as herbicides. They are rated as among the most dangerous materials of this type in use in the United States. Dinitrophenol is a strong metabolic stimulant. For this reason, it was at one time used as a reducing drug, but the margin between the slimming dose and that required to poison or kill was slight. So slight that several patients died and many suffered permanent injury before use of the drug was finally halted. A related chemical, pentachlorophenol, sometimes known as penta, is used as a weed killer as well as an insecticide, often being sprayed along railroad tracks and in waste areas. Penta is extremely toxic to a wide variety of organisms, from bacteria to man. Like the dinitros, it interferes often fatally with the body's source of energy, so that the affected organism almost literally burns itself up. Its fearful power is illustrated in a fatal accident recently reported by the California Department of Health. A tank truck driver was preparing a cotton defoliant by mixing diesel oil with pentachlorophenol. As he was drawing the concentrated chemical out of a drum, the spigot accidentally toppled back. He reached in with his bare hand to regain the spigot. Although he washed immediately, he became acutely ill and died the next day. While the results of weed killers such as sodium arsenite or the phenols are grossly obvious, some other herbicides are more insidious in their effects. For example, the now famous cranberry weed killer, aminotriazole, or amitrol, is rated as having relatively low toxicity. But in the long run, its tendency to cause malignant tumors of the thyroid may be far more significant for wildlife and perhaps also for man. Among the herbicides are some that are classified as mutagens, or agents capable of modifying the genes, the materials of heredity. We are rightly appalled by the genetic effects of radiation. How then can we be indifferent to the same effect in chemicals that we disseminate widely in our environment? Chapter 4. Surface Waters and Underground Seas. Of all our natural resources, water has become the most precious. By far the greater part of the Earth's surface is covered by its enveloping seas, yet in the midst of this plenty, we are in want. By a strange paradox, most of the Earth's abundant water is not usable for agriculture, industry, or human consumption because of its heavy load of sea salts. And so most of the world's population is either experiencing or is threatened with critical shortages. In an age when man has forgotten his origins and is blind even to his most essential needs for survival, water, along with other resources, has become the victim of his indifference. The problem of water pollution by pesticides can be understood only in context, as part of the whole to which it belongs, the pollution of the total environment of mankind. The pollution entering our waterways comes from many sources: radioactive wastes from reactors, laboratories, and hospitals, fallout from nuclear explosions, domestic wastes from cities and towns, chemical wastes from factories. To these is added a new kind of fallout: the chemical sprays applied to croplands and gardens, forests and fields. Many of the chemical agents in this alarming mélange imitate and augment the harmful effects of radiation. And within the groups of chemicals themselves, there are sinister and little understood interactions, transformations, and summations of effect. Ever since chemists began to manufacture substances that nature never invented, the problems of water purification have become complex and the danger to users of water has increased. As we have seen, the production of these synthetic chemicals in large volume began in the 1940s. It has now reached such proportions that an appalling deluge of chemical pollution is daily poured into the nation's waterways. When inextricably mixed with domestic and other wastes discharged into the same water, these chemicals sometimes defy detection by the methods in ordinary use by purification plants. Most of them are so stable that they cannot be broken down by ordinary processes. Often they cannot even be identified. In rivers, a really incredible variety of pollutants combine to produce deposits that the sanitary engineers can only despairingly refer to as gunk. Professor Rolf Eliasson of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology testified before a congressional committee to the impossibility of predicting the composite effect of these chemicals or of identifying the organic matter resulting from the mixture. "We don't begin to know what that is," said Professor Eliasson. "What is the effect on the people? We don't know." To an ever-increasing degree, chemicals used for the control of insects, rodents, or unwanted vegetation contribute to these organic pollutants. Some are deliberately applied to bodies of water to destroy plants, insect larvae, or undesired fishes. Some come from forest spraying that may blanket 2 or 3 million acres of a single state with spray directed against a single insect pest. spray that falls directly into streams or that drips down through the leafy canopy to the forest floor, there to become part of the slow movement of seeping moisture beginning its long journey to the sea. Probably the bulk of such contaminants are the waterborne residues of the millions of pounds of agricultural chemicals that have been applied to farmlands for insect or rodent control and have been leached out of the ground by rains to become part of the universal seaward movement of water. Here and there we have dramatic evidence of the presence of these chemicals in our streams and even in public water supplies. For example, a sample of drinking water from an orchard area in Pennsylvania when tested on fish in a laboratory contained enough insecticide to kill all the test fish in only 4 hours. Water from a stream draining sprayed cotton fields remained lethal to fishes even after it had passed through a purifying plant. And in 15 streams, tributary to the Tennessee River in Alabama, the runoff from fields treated with toxaphene, a chlorinated hydrocarbon, killed all the fish inhabiting the streams. Two of these streams were sources of municipal water supply. Yet for a week after the application of the insecticide, the water remained poisonous, a fact attested by the daily deaths of goldfish suspended in cages downstream. For the most part, this pollution is unseen and invisible, making its presence known when hundreds or thousands of fish die, but more often, never detected at all. The chemist who guards water purity has no routine tests for these organic pollutants and no way to remove them. But whether detected or not, the pesticides are there, and as might be expected with any materials applied to land surfaces on so vast a scale, they have now found their way into many and perhaps all of the major river systems of the country. If anyone doubts that our waters have become almost universally contaminated with insecticides, he should study a small report issued by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service in 1960. The service had carried out studies to discover whether fish, like warm-blooded animals, store insecticides in their tissues. The first samples were taken from forest areas in the West, where there had been mass spraying of DDT for the control of the spruce budworm. As might have been expected, all of these fish contained DDT. The really significant findings were made when the investigators turned for comparison to a creek in a remote area about 30 miles from the nearest spraying for budworm control. This creek was upstream from the first and separated from it by a high waterfall. No local spraying was known to have occurred. Yet these fish, too, contained DDT. Had the chemical reached this remote creek by hidden underground streams, or had it been airborne, drifting down as fallout on the surface of the creek? In still another comparative study, DDT was found in the tissues of fish from a hatchery where the water supply originated in a deep well. Again, there was no record of local spraying. The only possible means of contamination seemed to be by means of groundwater. In the entire water pollution problem, there is probably nothing more disturbing than the threat of widespread contamination of groundwater. It is not possible to add pesticides to water anywhere without threatening the purity of water everywhere. Seldom, if ever, does nature operate in closed and separate compartments, and she has not done so in distributing the Earth's water supply. Rain, falling on the land, settles down through pores and cracks in soil and rock, penetrating deeper and deeper until eventually it reaches a zone where all the pores of the rock are filled with water, a dark subsurface sea rising under hills, sinking beneath valleys. This groundwater is always on the move, sometimes at a pace so slow that it travels no more than 50 feet a year, sometimes rapidly by comparison, so that it moves nearly a tenth of a mile in a day. It travels by unseen waterways until here and there it comes to the surface as a spring, or perhaps it is tapped to feed a well. but mostly it contributes to streams and so to rivers. Except for what enters streams directly as rain or surface runoff, all the running water on the Earth's surface was at one time groundwater. And so in a very real and frightening sense, pollution of the groundwater is pollution of water everywhere. It must have been by such a dark underground sea that poisonous chemicals traveled from a manufacturing plant in Colorado to a farming district several miles away, there to poison wells, sicken humans and livestock, and damage crops. An extraordinary episode that may easily be only the first of many like it. Its history in brief is this. In 1943, the Rocky Mountain Arsenal of the Army Chemical Corps, located near Denver, began to manufacture war materials. 8 years later, the facilities of the arsenal were leased to a private oil company for the production of insecticides. Even before the change of operations, however, mysterious reports had begun to come in. Farmers several miles from the plant began to report unexplained sickness among livestock. They complained of extensive crop damage. Foliage turned yellow, plants failed to mature, and many crops were killed outright. There were reports of human illness, thought by some to be related. The irrigation waters on these farms were derived from shallow wells. When the well waters were examined, in a study in 1959 in which several state and federal agencies participated, they were found to contain an assortment of chemicals. Chlorides, chlorates, salts of phosphonic acid, fluorides, and arsenic had been discharged from the Rocky Mountain Arsenal into holding ponds during the years of its operation. Apparently, the groundwater between the arsenal and the farms had become contaminated, and it had taken 7 to 8 years for the wastes to travel underground a distance of about 3 miles from the holding ponds to the nearest farm. This seepage had continued to spread and had further contaminated an area of unknown extent. The investigators knew of no way to contain the contamination or halt its advance. All this was bad enough, but the most mysterious and probably in the long run the most significant feature of the whole episode was the discovery of the weed killer 2,4-D in some of the wells and in the holding ponds of the arsenal. Certainly its presence was enough to account for the damage to crops irrigated with this water. But the mystery lay in the fact that no 2,4-D had been manufactured at the arsenal at any stage of its operations. After long and careful study, the chemists at the plant concluded that 2,4-D had been formed spontaneously in the open basins. It had been formed there from other substances discharged from the arsenal, in the presence of air, water, and sunlight, and quite without the intervention of human chemists. The holding ponds had become chemical laboratories for the production of a new chemical, a chemical fatally damaging to much of the plant life it touched. And so the story of the Colorado farms and their damaged crops assumes a significance that transcends its local importance. What other parallels may there be, not only in Colorado, but wherever chemical pollution finds its way into public waters? In lakes and streams, everywhere, in the presence of catalyzing air and sunlight, what dangerous substances may be born of parent chemicals labeled harmless? Indeed, one of the most alarming aspects of the chemical pollution of water is the fact that here, in river or lake or reservoir, or for that matter in the glass of water served at your dinner table, are mingled chemicals that no responsible chemist would think of combining in his laboratory. The possible interactions between these freely mixed chemicals are deeply disturbing to officials of the United States Public Health Service, who have expressed the fear that the production of harmful substances from comparatively innocuous chemicals may be taking place on quite a wide scale. The reactions may be between two or more chemicals, or between chemicals and the radioactive wastes that are being discharged into our rivers in ever-increasing volume. Under the impact of ionizing radiation, some rearrangement of atoms could easily occur, changing the nature of the chemicals in a way that is not only unpredictable, but beyond control. It is, of course, not only the groundwaters that are becoming contaminated, but surface-moving waters as well. Streams, rivers, irrigation waters. A disturbing example of the latter seems to be building up on the National Wildlife Refuges at Tule Lake and Lower Klamath, both in California. These refuges are part of a chain, including also the refuge on Upper Klamath Lake, just over the border in Oregon. All are linked, perhaps fatefully, by a shared water supply, and all are affected by the fact that they lie like small islands in a great sea of surrounding farmlands, land reclaimed by drainage and stream diversion from an original waterfowl paradise of marshland and open water. These farmlands around the refuges are now irrigated by water from Upper Klamath Lake. The irrigation waters recollected from the fields they have served are then pumped into Tule Lake and from there to Lower Klamath. All of the waters of the wildlife refuges established on these two bodies of water therefore represent the drainage of agricultural lands. It is important to remember this in connection with recent happenings. In the summer of 1960, the refuge staff picked up hundreds of dead and dying birds at Tule Lake in Lower Klamath. Most of them were fish-eating species, herons, pelicans, grebes, gulls. Upon analysis, they were found to contain insecticide residues identified as toxaphene, DDD and DDE. Fish from the lakes were also found to contain insecticides. So did samples of plankton. The refuge manager believes that pesticide residues are now building up in the waters of these refuges, being conveyed there by return irrigation flow from heavily sprayed agricultural lands. Such poisoning of waters set aside for conservation purposes could have consequences felt by every Western duck hunter, and by everyone to whom the sight and sound of drifting ribbons of waterfowl across an evening sky are precious. These particular refuges occupy critical positions in the conservation of Western waterfowl. They lie at a point corresponding to the narrow neck of a funnel into which all the migratory paths composing what is known as the Pacific Flyway converge. During the fall migration, they receive many millions of ducks and geese from nesting grounds extending from the shores of Bering Sea east to Hudson Bay. Fully 3/4 of all the waterfowl that move south into the Pacific coast states in autumn. In summer, they provide nesting areas for waterfowl, especially for two endangered species, the redhead and the ruddy duck. If the lakes and pools of these refuges become seriously contaminated, the damage to the waterfowl populations of the Far West could be irreparable. Water must also be thought of in terms of the chains of life it supports. From the smallest dust-green cells of the drifting plant plankton, through the minute water fleas, to the fishes that strain plankton from the water and are in turn eaten by other fishes or by birds, mink, raccoons, in an endless cyclic transfer of materials from life to life. We know that the necessary minerals in the water are so passed from link to link of the food chains. Can we suppose that poisons we introduce into water will not also enter into these cycles of nature? The answer is to be found in the amazing history of Clear Lake, California. Clear Lake lies in mountainous country some 90 miles north of San Francisco and has long been popular with anglers. The name is inappropriate, for actually it is a rather turbid lake because of the soft black ooze that covers its shallow bottom. Unfortunately for the fishermen and the resort dwellers on its shores, its waters have provided an ideal habitat for a small gnat, Cheoborus astictopus. Although closely related to mosquitoes, the gnat is not a bloodsucker and probably does not feed at all as an adult. However, human beings who shared its habitat found it annoying because of its sheer numbers. Efforts were made to control it, but they were largely fruitless, until in the late 1940s, the chlorinated hydrocarbon insecticides offered new weapons. The chemical chosen for a fresh attack was DDD, a close relative of DDT, but apparently offering fewer threats to fish life. The new control measures undertaken in 1949 were carefully planned, and few people would have supposed any harm could result. The lake was surveyed, its volume determined, and the insecticide applied in such great dilution that for every part of chemical, there would be 70 million parts of water. Control of the gnats was at first good, but by 1954 the treatment had to be repeated, this time at the rate of one part of insecticide in 50 million parts of water. The destruction of the gnats was thought to be virtually complete. The following winter months brought the first intimation that other life was affected. The western grebes on the lake began to die, and soon more than 100 of them were reported dead. At Clear Lake, the western grebe is a breeding bird and also a winter visitant, attracted by the abundant fish of the lake. It is a bird of spectacular appearance and beguiling habits, building its floating nests in shallow lakes of western United States and Canada. It is called the swan grebe with reason, for it glides with scarcely a ripple across the lake surface. The body riding low, white neck and shining black head held high. The newly hatched chick is clothed in soft gray down. In only a few hours it takes to the water and rides on the back of the father or mother nestled under the parental wing coverts. Following a third assault on the ever-resilient gnat population in 1957, more grebes died. As had been true in 1954, no evidence of infectious disease could be discovered on examination of the dead birds. But when someone thought to analyze the fatty tissues of the grebes, they were found to be loaded with DDD in the extraordinary concentration of 1,600 parts per million. The maximum concentration applied to the water was 1/50th part per million. How could the chemical have built up to such prodigious levels in the grebes? These birds, of course, are fish eaters. When the fish of Clear Lake also were analyzed, the picture began to take form, the poison being picked up by the smaller organisms, concentrated, and passed on to the larger predators. Plankton organisms were found to contain about 5 parts per million of the insecticide, about 25 times the maximum concentration ever reached in the water itself. Plant-eating fishes had built up accumulations ranging from 40 to 300 parts per million. Carnivorous species had stored the most of all. One, a brown bullhead, had the astounding concentration of 2,500 parts per million. It was a house that Jack built sequence, in which the large carnivores had eaten the smaller carnivores, that had eaten the herbivores, that had eaten the plankton, that had absorbed the poison from the water. Even more extraordinary discoveries were made later. No trace of DDD could be found in the water shortly after the last application of the chemical. But the poison had not really left the lake. It had merely gone into the fabric of the life the lake supports. 23 months after the chemical treatment had ceased, the plankton still contained as much as 5.3 parts per million. In that interval of nearly 2 years, successive crops of plankton had flowered and faded away, but the poison, although no longer present in the water, had somehow passed from generation to generation. And it lived on in the animal life of the lake as well. All fish, birds and frogs examined a year after the chemical applications had ceased still contain DDD. The amount found in the flesh always exceeded by many times the original concentration in the water. Among these living carriers were fish that had hatched 9 months after the last DDD application, grebes and California gulls that had built up concentrations of more than 2,000 parts per million. Meanwhile, the nesting colonies of the grebes dwindled from more than 1,000 pairs before the first insecticide treatment to about 30 pairs in 1960. And even the 30 seemed to have nested in vain, for no young grebes had been observed on the lake since the last DDD application. This whole chain of poisoning, then, seems to rest on a base of minute plants, which must have been the original concentrators. But what of the opposite end of the food chain, the human being, who, in probable ignorance of all this sequence of events, has rigged his fishing tackle, caught a string of fish from the waters of Clear Lake, and taken them home to fry for his supper? What could a heavy dose of DDD, or perhaps repeated doses, do to him? Although the California Department of Public Health professed to see no hazard, nevertheless, in 1959, it required that the use of DDD in the lake be stopped. In view of the scientific evidence of the vast biological potency of this chemical, the action seems a minimum safety measure. The physiological effect of DDD is probably unique among insecticides, for it destroys part of the adrenal gland, the cells of the outer layer known as the adrenal cortex, which secretes the hormone cortin. This destructive effect, known since 1948, was at first believed to be confined to dogs because it was not revealed in such experimental animals as monkeys, rats, or rabbits. It seems suggestive, however, that DDD produced in dogs a condition very similar to that occurring in man in the presence of Addison's disease. Recent medical research has revealed that DDD does strongly suppress the function of the human adrenal cortex. Its cell-destroying capacity is now clinically utilized in the treatment of a rare type of cancer which develops in the adrenal gland. The Clear Lake situation brings up a question that the public needs to face. Is it wise or desirable to use substances with such strong effect on physiological processes for the control of insects, especially when the control measures involve introducing the chemical directly into a body of water? The fact that the insecticide was applied in very low concentrations is meaningless, as its explosive progress through the natural food chain in the lake demonstrates. Yet Clear Lake is typical of a large and growing number of situations where solution of an obvious and often trivial problem creates a far more serious but conveniently less tangible one. Here the problem was resolved in favor of those annoyed by gnats, and at the expense of an unstated and probably not even clearly understood risk to all who took food or water from the lake. It is an extraordinary fact that the deliberate introduction of poisons into a reservoir is becoming a fairly common practice. The purpose is usually to promote recreational uses, even though the water must then be treated at some expense to make it fit for its intended use as drinking water. When sportsmen of an area want to improve fishing in a reservoir, they prevail on authorities to dump quantities of poison into it to kill the undesired fish, which are then replaced with hatchery fish more suited to sportsmen's taste. The procedure has a strange Alice in Wonderland quality. The reservoir was created as a public water supply, yet the community, probably unconsulted about the sportsman's project, is forced either to drink water containing poisonous residues or to pay out tax money for treatment of the water to remove the poisons. Treatments that are by no means foolproof. As ground and surface waters are contaminated with pesticides and other chemicals, there is danger that not only poisonous but also cancer-producing substances are being introduced into public water supplies. Dr. W.C. Huper of the National Cancer Institute has warned that the danger of cancer hazards from the consumption of contaminated drinking water will grow considerably within the foreseeable future. And indeed, a study made in Holland in the early 1950s provides support for the view that polluted waterways may carry a cancer hazard. Cities receiving their drinking water from rivers had a higher death rate from cancer than did those whose water came from sources presumably less susceptible to pollution, such as wells. Arsenic, the environmental substance most clearly established as causing cancer in man, is involved in two historic cases in which polluted water supplies caused widespread occurrence of cancer. In one case, the arsenic came from the slag heaps of mining operations, in the other, from rock with a high natural content of arsenic. These conditions may easily be duplicated as a result of heavy applications of arsenical insecticides. The soil in such areas becomes poisoned. Rains then carry part of the arsenic into streams, rivers, and reservoirs, as well as into the vast subterranean seas of groundwater. Here again we are reminded that in nature nothing exists alone. To understand more clearly how the pollution of our world is happening, we must now look at another of the Earth's basic resources, the soil. Chapter 5. Realms of the Soil. The thin layer of soil that forms a patchy covering over the continents controls our own existence and that of every other animal of the land. Without soil, land plants as we know them could not grow, and without plants, no animal could survive. Yet if our agriculture-based life depends on the soil, it is equally true that soil depends on life. Its very origins and the maintenance of its true nature being intimately related to living plants and animals. For soil is in part a creation of life, born of a marvelous interaction of life and non-life long eons ago. The parent materials were gathered together as volcanoes poured them out in fiery streams, as waters running over the bare rocks of the continents wore away even the hardest granite, and as the chisels of frost and ice split and shattered the rocks. Then living things began to work their creative magic, and little by little these inert materials became soil. Lichens, the rock's first covering, aided the process of disintegration by their acid secretions and made a lodging place for other life. Mosses took hold in the little pockets of simple soil, soil formed by crumbling bits of lichen, by the husks of minute insect life, by the debris of a fauna beginning its emergence from the sea. Life not only formed the soil, but other living things of incredible abundance and diversity now exist within it. If this were not so, the soil would be a dead and sterile thing. By their presence and by their activities, the myriad organisms of the soil make it capable of supporting the Earth's green mantle. The soil exists in a state of constant change, taking part in cycles that have no beginning and no end. New materials are constantly being contributed as rocks disintegrate, as organic matter decays, and as nitrogen and other gases are brought down in rain from the skies. At the same time, other materials are being taken away, borrowed for temporary use by living creatures. Subtle and vastly important chemical changes are constantly in progress, converting elements derived from air and water into forms suitable for use by plants. In all these changes, living organisms are active agents. There are few studies more fascinating and at the same time more neglected than those of the teeming populations that exist in the dark realms of the soil. We know too little of the threads that bind the soil organisms to each other, and to their world, and to the world above. Perhaps the most essential organisms in the soil are the smallest. the invisible hosts of bacteria and of thread-like fungi. Statistics of their abundance take us at once into astronomical figures. A teaspoonful of topsoil may contain billions of bacteria. In spite of their minute size, the total weight of this host of bacteria in the top foot of a single acre of fertile soil may be as much as 1,000 pounds. Ray fungi, growing in long thread-like filaments, are somewhat less numerous than the bacteria, yet because they are larger, their total weight in a given amount of soil may be about the same. With small green cells called algae, these make up the microscopic plant life of the soil. Bacteria, fungi, and algae are the principal agents of decay, reducing plant and animal residues to their component minerals. The vast cyclic movements of chemical elements, such as carbon and nitrogen, through soil and air and living tissues, could not proceed without these microplants. Without the nitrogen-fixing bacteria, for example, plants would starve for want of nitrogen, though surrounded by a sea of nitrogen-containing air. Other organisms form carbon dioxide, which, as carbonic acid, aids in dissolving rock. Still other soil microbes perform various oxidations and reductions by which minerals such as iron, manganese, and sulfur are transformed and made available to plants. Also present in prodigious numbers are microscopic mites and primitive wingless insects called springtails. Despite their small size, they play an important part in breaking down the residues of plants, aiding in the slow conversion of the litter of the forest floor to soil. The specialization of some of these minute creatures for their task is almost incredible. Several species of mites, for example, can begin life only within the fallen needles of a spruce tree. Sheltered here, they digest out the inner tissues of the needle. When the mites have completed their development, only the outer layer of cells remains. The truly staggering task of dealing with a tremendous amount of plant material in the annual leaf fall belongs to some of the small insects of the soil and the forest floor. They macerate and digest the leaves and aid in mixing the decomposed matter with the surface soil. Besides all this horde of minute but ceaselessly toiling creatures, there are, of course, many larger forms, for soil life runs the gamut from bacteria to mammals. Some are permanent residents of the dark subsurface layers. Some hibernate or spend definite parts of their life cycles in underground chambers. Some freely come and go between their burrows and the upper world. In general, the effect of all this habitation of the soil is to aerate it and improve both its drainage and the penetration of water throughout the layers of plant growth. Of all the larger inhabitants of the soil, probably none is more important than the earthworm. Over 75 years ago, Charles Darwin published a book titled The Formation of Vegetable Mold Through the Action of Worms with Observations on Their Habits. In it, he gave the world its first understanding of the fundamental role of earthworms as geologic agents for the transport of soil. A picture of surface rocks being gradually covered by fine soil brought up from below by the worms, in annual amounts running to many tons to the acre in most favorable areas. At the same time, quantities of organic matter contained in leaves and grass, as much as 20 pounds to the square yard in 6 months, are drawn down into the burrows and incorporated in the soil. Darwin's calculation showed that the toil of earthworms might add a layer of soil 1 to 1.5 inches thick in a 10-year period. And this is by no means all they do. Their burrows aerate the soil, keep it well drained, and aid the penetration of plant roots. The presence of earthworms increases the nitrifying powers of the soil bacteria and decreases putrefaction of the soil. Organic matter is broken down as it passes through the digestive tracts of the worms, and the soil is enriched by their excretory products. This soil community then consists of a web of interwoven lives, each in some way related to the others. The living creatures depending on the soil, but the soil in turn, a vital element of the earth, only so long as this community within it flourishes. The problem that concerns us here is one that has received little consideration. What happens to these incredibly numerous and vitally necessary inhabitants of the soil when poisonous chemicals are carried down into their world? Either introduced directly as soil sterilants, or borne on the rain that has picked up a lethal contamination as it filters through the leaf canopy of forest and orchard and cropland. Is it reasonable to suppose that we can apply a broad-spectrum insecticide to kill the burrowing larval stages of a crop-destroying insect, for example, without also killing the good insects, whose function may be the essential one of breaking down organic matter? Or can we use a non-specific fungicide without also killing the fungi that inhabit the roots of many trees in a beneficial association that aids the tree in extracting nutrients from the soil? The plain truth is that this critically important subject of the ecology of the soil has been largely neglected, even by scientists, and almost completely ignored by control men. Chemical control of insects seems to have proceeded on the assumption that the soil could and would sustain any amount of insult via the introduction of poisons without striking back. The very nature of the world of the soil has been largely ignored. From the few studies that have been made, a picture of the impact of pesticides on the soil is slowly emerging. It is not surprising that the studies are not always in agreement, for soil types vary so enormously that what causes damage in one may be innocuous in another. Light, sandy soils suffer far more heavily than humus types. Combinations of chemicals seem to do more harm than separate applications. Despite the varying results, enough solid evidence of harm is accumulating to cause apprehension on the part of many scientists. Under some conditions, the chemical conversions and transformations that lie at the very heart of the living world are affected. Nitrification, which makes atmospheric nitrogen available to plants, is an example. The herbicide 2,4-D causes a temporary interruption of nitrification. In recent experiments in Florida, lindane, heptachlor, and BHC, benzene hexachloride, reduced nitrification after only 2 weeks in soil. BHC and DDT had significantly detrimental effects a year after treatment. In other experiments, BHC, aldrin, lindane, heptachlor, and DDD all prevented nitrogen-fixing bacteria from forming the necessary root nodules on leguminous plants. A curious but beneficial relation between fungi and the roots of higher plants is seriously disrupted. Sometimes the problem is one of upsetting that delicate balance of populations by which nature accomplishes far-reaching aims. Explosive increases in some kind of soil organisms have occurred when others have been reduced by insecticides, disturbing the relation of predator to prey. Such changes could easily alter the metabolic activity of the soil and affect its productivity. They could also mean that potentially harmful organisms, formerly held in check, could escape from their natural controls and rise to pest status. One of the most important things to remember about insecticides in soil is their long persistence, measured not in months, but in years. Aldrin has been recovered after 4 years, both as traces and more abundantly as converted to dieldrin. Enough toxaphene remains in sandy soil 10 years after its application to kill termites. Benzene hexachloride persists at least 11 years. Heptachlor, or a more toxic derived chemical, at least 9. Chlordane has been recovered 12 years after its application, in the amount of 15% of the original quantity. Seemingly moderate applications of insecticides over a period of years may build up fantastic quantities in soil. Since the chlorinated hydrocarbons are persistent and long-lasting, each application is merely added to the quantity remaining from the previous one. The old legend that a pound of DDT to the acre is harmless means nothing if spraying is repeated. Potato soils have been found to contain up to 15 pounds of DDT per acre, corn soils up to 19. A cranberry bog under study contained 34.5 pounds to the acre. Soils from apple orchards seem to reach the peak of contamination, with DDT accumulating at a rate that almost keeps pace with its rate of annual application. Even in a single season with orchards sprayed four or more times, DDT residues may build up to peaks of 30 to 50 pounds. With repeated sprayings over the years, the range between trees is from 26 to 60 pounds to the acre. Under trees, up to 113 pounds. Arsenic provides a classic case of the virtually permanent poisoning of the soil. Although arsenic as a spray on growing tobacco has been largely replaced by the synthetic organic insecticide since the mid-1940s, the arsenic content of cigarettes made from American-grown tobacco increased more than 300% between the years 1932 and 1952. Later studies have revealed increases of as much as 600%. Dr. Henry S. Satterley, an authority on arsenic toxicology, says that although organic insecticides have been largely substituted for arsenic, the tobacco plants continue to pick up the old poison, for the soils of tobacco plantations are now thoroughly impregnated with the residues of a heavy and relatively insoluble poison, arsenate of lead. This will continue to release arsenic in soluble form. The soil of a large proportion of the land planted to tobacco has been subjected to cumulative and well-nigh permanent poisoning, according to Dr. Satterley. Tobacco grown in the eastern Mediterranean countries, where arsenical insecticides are not used, has shown no such increase in arsenic content. We are therefore confronted with a second problem. We must not only be concerned with what is happening to the soil, we must wonder to what extent insecticides are absorbed from contaminated soils and introduced into plant tissues. Much depends on the type of soil, the crop, and the nature and concentration of the insecticide. Soil high in organic matter releases smaller quantities of poisons than others. Carrots absorb more insecticide than any other crop studied. If the chemical used happens to be lindane, carrots actually accumulate higher concentrations than are present in the soil. In the future, it may become necessary to analyze soils for insecticides before planting certain food crops. Otherwise, even unsprayed crops may take up enough insecticide merely from the soil to render them unfit for market. This very sort of contamination has created endless problems for at least one leading manufacturer of baby foods who has been unwilling to buy any fruits or vegetables on which toxic insecticides have been used. The chemical that caused him the most trouble was benzene hexachloride, BHC, which is taken up by the roots and tubers of plants, advertising its presence by a musty taste and odor. Sweet potatoes grown on California fields where BHC had been used 2 years earlier contained residues and had to be rejected. In 1 year, in which the firm had contracted in South Carolina for its total requirements of sweet potatoes, so large a proportion of the acreage was found to be contaminated that the company was forced to buy in the open market at a considerable financial loss. Over the years, a variety of fruits and vegetables grown in various states have had to be rejected. The most stubborn problems were concerned with peanuts. In the southern states, peanuts are usually grown in rotation with cotton, on which BHC is extensively used. Peanuts grown later in the soil pick up considerable amounts of the insecticide. Actually, only a trace is enough to incorporate the telltale musty odor and taste. The chemical penetrates the nuts and cannot be removed. Processing, far from removing the mustiness, sometimes accentuates it. the only course open to a manufacturer determined to exclude BHC residues is to reject all produce treated with the chemical or grown on soils contaminated with it. Sometimes the menace is to the crop itself, a menace that remains as long as the insecticide contamination is in the soil. Some insecticides affect sensitive plants such as beans, wheat, barley, or rye, retarding root development or depressing growth of seedlings. The experience of the hop growers in Washington and Idaho is an example. During the spring of 1955, many of these growers undertook a large-scale program to control the strawberry root weevil, whose larvae had become abundant on the roots of the hops. On the advice of agricultural experts and insecticide manufacturers, they chose heptachlor as the control agent. Within a year after the heptachlor was applied, the vines and the treated yards were wilting and dying. In the untreated fields, there was no trouble. The damage stopped at the border between treated and untreated fields. The hills were replanted at great expense, but in another year, the new roots, too, were found to be dead. 4 years later, the soil still contained heptachlor, and scientists were unable to predict how long it would remain poisonous, or to recommend any procedure for correcting the condition. The Federal Department of Agriculture, which as late as March 1959, found itself in the anomalous position of declaring heptachlor to be acceptable for use on hops in the form of soil treatment, belatedly withdrew its registration for such use. Meanwhile, the hop growers sought what redress they could in the courts. As applications of pesticides continue and the virtually indestructible residues continue to build up in the soil, it is almost certain that we are heading for trouble. This was the consensus of a group of specialists who met at Syracuse University in 1960 to discuss the ecology of the soil. These men summed up the hazards of using such potent and little understood tools as chemicals and radiation. A few false moves on the part of man may result in destruction of soil productivity, and the arthropods may well take over. Chapter 6. Earth's Green Mantle. Water, soil, and the Earth's green mantle of plants make up the world that supports the animal life of the Earth. Although modern man seldom remembers the fact, he could not exist without the plants that harness the sun's energy and manufacture the basic foodstuffs he depends upon for life. Our attitude towards plants is a singularly narrow one. If we see any immediate utility in a plant, we foster it. If for any reason we find its presence undesirable or merely a matter of indifference, we may condemn it to destruction forthwith. Besides the various plants that are poisonous to man or his livestock, or crowd out food plants, many are marked for destruction merely because, according to our narrow view, they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Many others are destroyed merely because they happen to be associates of the unwanted plants. The Earth's vegetation is part of a web of life in which there are intimate and essential relations between plants and the Earth, between plants and other plants, between plants and animals. Sometimes we have no choice but to disturb these relationships, but we should do so thoughtfully, with full awareness that what we do may have consequences remote in time and place. But no such humility marks the booming weed-killer business of the present day, in which soaring sales and expanding uses mark the production of plant-killing chemicals. One of the most tragic examples of our unthinking bludgeoning of the landscape is to be seen in the sagebrush lands of the West, where a vast campaign is on to destroy the sage and to substitute grasslands. If ever an enterprise needed to be illuminated with a sense of the history and meaning of the landscape, it is this. For here the natural landscape is eloquent of the interplay of forces that have created it. It is spread before us like the pages of an open book in which we can read why the land is what it is and why we should preserve its integrity. but the pages lie unread. The land of the sage is the land of high western plains and the lower slopes of the mountains that rise above them, a land born of the great uplift of the Rocky Mountain system many millions of years ago. It is a place of harsh extremes of climate, of long winters when blizzards drive down from the mountains and snow lies deep on the plains, of summers whose heat is relieved by only scanty rains, with drought biting deep into the soil and drying winds stealing moisture from leaf and stem. As the landscape evolved, there must have been a long period of trial and error in which plants attempted the colonization of this high and windswept land. One after another must have failed. At last, one group of plants evolved which combined all the qualities needed to survive. The sage, low-growing and shrubby, could hold its place on the mountain slopes and on the plains. And within its small gray leaves, it could hold moisture enough to defy the thieving winds. It was no accident, but rather the result of long ages of experimentation by nature, that the Great Plains of the West became the land of the sage. Along with the plants, animal life too was evolving in harmony with the searching requirements of the land. In time, there were two as perfectly adjusted to their habitat as the sage. One was a mammal, the fleet and graceful pronghorn antelope. The other was a bird, the sage grouse, the cock of the plains of Lewis and Clark. The sage and the grouse seemed made for each other. The original range of the bird coincided with the range of the sage, and as the sage lands have been reduced, so the populations of grouse have dwindled. The sage is all things to these birds of the plains. The low sage of the foothill ranges shelters their nests and their young. The denser growths are loafing and roosting areas. At all times, the sage provides the staple food of the grouse. Yet it is a two-way relationship. The spectacular courtship displays of the cocks help loosen the soil beneath and around the sage, aiding invasion by grasses which grow in the shelter of sagebrush. The antelope, too, have adjusted their lives to the sage. They are primarily animals of the plains, and in winter, when the first snow comes, those that have summered in the mountains move down to the lower elevations. There the sage provides the food that tides them over the winter. Where all other plants have shed their leaves, the sage remains evergreen, the gray-green leaves bitter, aromatic, rich in proteins, fats, and needed minerals, clinging to the stems of the dense and shrubby plants. Though the snows pile up, the tops of the sage remain exposed or can be reached by the sharp, pawing hooves of the antelope. Then grouse feed on them too, finding them on bare and windswept ledges, or following the antelope to feed where they have scratched away the snow. And other life looks to the sage. Mule deer often feed on it. Sage may mean survival for winter grazing livestock. Sheep graze many winter ranges where the big sagebrush forms almost pure stands. For half the year, it is their principal forage, a plant of higher energy value than even alfalfa hay. The bitter upland plains, the purple wastes of sage, the wild swift antelope and the grouse are then a natural system in perfect balance. R. The verb must be changed. At least in those already vast and growing areas where man is attempting to improve on nature's way. In the name of progress, the land management agencies have set about to satisfy the insatiable demands of the cattlemen for more grazing land. By this they mean grassland, grass without sage. So in a land which nature found suited to grass growing, mixed with and under the shelter of sage, it is now proposed to eliminate the sage and create unbroken grassland. Few seem to have asked whether grasslands are a stable and desirable goal in this region. Certainly nature's own answer was otherwise. The annual precipitation in this land, where the rains seldom fall, is not enough to support good sod-forming grass. It favors, rather, the perennial bunch grass that grows in the shelter of the sage. Yet the program of sage eradication has been underway for a number of years. Several government agencies are active in it. Industry is joined with enthusiasm to promote and encourage an enterprise which creates expanded markets not only for grass seed, but for a large assortment of machines for cutting and plowing and seeding. The newest addition to the weapons is the use of chemical sprays. Now millions of acres of sagebrush lands are sprayed each year. What are the results? The eventual effects of eliminating sage and seeding with grass are largely conjectural. Men of long experience with the ways of the land say that in this country there is better growth of grass between and under the sage that can possibly be had in pure stands once the moisture-holding sage is gone. But even if the program succeeds in its immediate objective, it is clear that the whole closely knit fabric of life has been ripped apart. The antelope and the grouse will disappear along with the sage. The deer will suffer too, and the land will be poorer for the destruction of the wild things that belong to it. Even the livestock, which are the intended beneficiaries, will suffer. No amount of lush green grass in summer can help the sheep starving in the winter storms for lack of the sage and bitterbrush and other wild vegetation of the plains. These are the first and obvious effects. The second is of a kind that is always associated with the shotgun approach to nature. The spraying also eliminates a great many plants that were not its intended target. Justice William O. Douglas, in his recent book, My Wilderness, East to Katahdin, has told of an appalling example of ecological destruction wrought by the United States Forest Service in the Bridger National Forest in Wyoming. Some 10,000 acres of sage lands were sprayed by the service, yielding to pressure of cattlemen for more grasslands. The sage was killed as intended, but so was the green, life-giving ribbon of willows that traced its way across these plains following the meandering streams. Moose had lived in these willow thickets, for willow is to the moose what sage is to the antelope. Beaver had lived there too, feeding on the willows, felling them, and making a strong dam across the tiny stream. Through the labor of the beavers, a lake backed up. Trout in the mountain streams seldom were more than 6 inches long. In the lake, they thrived so prodigiously that many grew to 5 pounds. Waterfowl were attracted to the lake also. Merely because of the presence of the willows and the beavers that depended on them, the region was an attractive recreational area with excellent fishing and hunting. But with the improvement instituted by the Forest Service, the willows went the way of the sagebrush, killed by the same impartial spray. When Justice Douglas visited the area in 1959, the year of the spraying, he was shocked to see the shriveled and dying willows, the vast, incredible damage. What would become of the moose, of the beavers, and the little world they had constructed? A year later, he returned to read the answers in the devastated landscape. The moose were gone, and so were the beaver. Their principal dam had gone out for want of attention by its skilled architects, and the lake had drained away. None of the large trout were left. None could live in the tiny creek that remained, threading its way through a bare, hot land where no shade remained. The living world was shattered.
This ends Disc 2.